Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Little Paul Peep has lost his sheep and can't tell where to find them.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss the second episode of season 6 of the Netflix show The Crown. It's titled Two Photographs.
Yeah, coming here today, I couldn't help being struck by the two very different cultures at play here. Saint-Tropez, Scotland.
And later on, Vanity Fair's royal watcher, Aaron Vanderhoof, will be stopping by to talk about the photographs in question.
But first, let's do a quick recap. Diana and Dodi are getting closer, and that causes concerns for the palace.
If one were to imagine a friendship between the Princess of Wales and Dodi Fayed becoming a committed relationship, there's not just the potential damage to the royal family from a public relations point of view, but also a fear that his father might use the association with the Princess of Wales as leverage and leave the authorities in an uncomfortable position.
Charles and Diana seem to make peace with their co-parenting situation.
All right, she said, giving the brave smile of the runner-up, not the winner. Let's be brilliant at divorce.
Thank you.
A photograph of Diana and Dodi kissing on a yacht sells for an eye-watering amount of money, causing a paparazzi frenzy.
The images have proven lucrative beyond anyone's wildest imaginings. And now that photographers realize they can become rich overnight, interest in the princess's private life is unlikely to die down anytime soon.
Meanwhile, Charles stages his own photo shoot to win back the front pages.
How would you feel about doing a counter photo? You and the princess.
Hasn't everyone had enough of photographs?
All right, so there's obviously a lot to talk about with this episode. The writers very shrewdly give us a kind of two-part framing device with these two photographers. The episode's called Two Photographs. I think what I kind of want to ask you guys up front about this episode is this is where we're getting into some real-life stuff that, like, may or may not have happened vis-a-vis Mohammed's involvement in hiring photographers, et cetera, et cetera. Diana takes a photo, the famous landmine photo, but that was not in the Balkans. That was in Angola in real life. So they kind of mushed some things together for that. Obviously, we'll be talking to royals experts who actually know the truth of this stuff, you know, on this episode and all other episodes of The Crown. But does that bother you guys? Like, how much are you looking for, like, exact historicity, and how much are you looking for a good story?
I'm looking for a good story. I could read a biography of Diana. I could read Tina Brown's biography of Diana if I wanted just the facts or whatnot. You have to create a narrative, and mm-hmm. I do think whether or not Mohammed did call the paparazzi to get that photo.
The official story, just so that we know, is that Mario Brenna, the paparazzo, just happened to spot the boat. He lives in Monaco.
And so he was there.
That is why he happened to be available to take those pictures that made him a millionaire.
This show suggests that it was all Mohammed.
That it was a setup and that it was specifically engineered in order to push Dodi and Diana's relationship into the public eye.
Yes, and further down the line, which while that may or may not be true, that's a heck of a lot more interesting than a guy just being like, oh, there's Princess Diana on a boat. Like, that's not as compelling. And it does sort of set up a more of a sort of a Shakespearean narrative
for
Muhammad.
It does, but I sort of see what Richard's saying, too, which is in setting up Muhammad as more of a villain, are you then kind of taking some of the pressure off and some of the blame off of the royal family,
yes.
like Charles specifically, which, you know, I feel like maybe we've talked about this already. I think maybe earlier seasons of the show were a little more critical of Queen Elizabeth specifically, and maybe not of, you know, the project of monarchy as a whole. But I do think that in these later seasons, like, they're very sympathetic to Charles. We talked about the breakdancing. I think
we're all breakdancing right now.
We have amazing breath control. But yeah, I think that the show does want you to. It wants you to have sympathy for Charles, and it wants to not have him be a bad guy. Like, it has her dropping the kids off. She and Charles have, like, a last conversation where he's like, hey, can we be friends? And she's like, I'd like that. And
that, yeah,
I don't
good.
Know. I feel like that's a little – that's yeah. it's pat. It makes the Charles stuff also, like, more dramatically inert, because if he is just, like, kind of a bad guy who, you know, stumbled into a bad situation, then, I don't know, he's not as interesting of a character either.
Yeah, I'll be curious to hear what other people think of this episode, because I think passing the blame onto a depiction of a conniving brown man pulling mm-hmm. the strings, it's just like, guys, is that really where you want to point this? Like, it's no one's fault. I mean, it's no one person's fault.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, it's a horrible accident. It's called an accident for a reason. It was avoidable, certainly.
Uh-huh.
But, like,
but yeah,
it's
a perfect storm kind of thing. There are multiple things that had to go wrong.
But yeah, for now, I'm a little bit like one ear is kind of perked up, where I'm like, I don't know if the way they're framing this is kind of interesting.
Oh, there's maybe sort of like a Jafar, like, mustache twirling.
Yeah.
Like, thing happening.
Oh, 100%. And especially with the focus on photography. And this whole season, we're seeing a lot more shots of, like, the paparazzi hounding Diana and hounding her and Dodi and whatnot. And the kids.
Yeah.
And for Muhammad to be responsible for the photograph that then sent the paparazzi to be so, so crazy. And that was sort of the death knell for them. It is a little, like... Ugh, that's...
But then does also make it a more interesting story, because, you know, it's kind of a classic Greek myth sort of thing where he is the cause of his son's own downfall. It's, you know, he, you know, wished on the wrong thing and got his wish in a way that he never wanted to.
Yeah.
He's Daedalus who made the wings for Icarus or whatever.
Yeah. He watches him fall into the sea. He watches him crash into that tunnel, and it's something that was his fault.
Yeah. Which,
according to the show,
which I guess I will say for future episodes, I will be looking and hoping to see Muhammad and the actor that plays him get, like, a really big moment of, like, a reckoning or some scene that makes this worth it, that makes him see the error of his ways or humanizes him beyond, like, a brown villain who's, you know, manipulating these, like, little white dolls that Diana is.
Right. Yeah, Salim Daw, the actor, he's so good.
He is so
good.
I hope
that he gets some awards attention, because I think he's going to be in a lot of this season.
Yeah.
And,
I think that he is doing a good job in a part that could have been flatter if the person playing him weren't as charismatic.
I think also the juxtaposition of Mario Brenna, the photographer you mentioned, Hillary, who is a real person and did become a millionaire from this one set of photos,
which is wild.
Including the beautiful, I mean, I hate to say it's beautiful because it was taken in a bad way, but, like, her sitting at the diving board in the blue suit, which is the poster
is
for the terrible
for
Naomi Watts Diana movie. But the way that they juxtapose that with this, just cheery little Scottish photographer who takes respectable photos of the royals
his wife is like, you like the queen more than me.
Yeah.
He's like, I do.
That felt a little bit
like... Should we
just
do the rest of the podcast in our little Oliver Twist accent?
I have some like stuff you could black your teeth out with, or you want to put fake soot on your cheeks or something.
Fresh. You drink. I'm sorry, Emily. Yeah. Our producer is actually British. So now I feel bad.
It's done out of respect, just like that photographer.
Everywhere, everyone she talks to all day in England, that's what they sound like. But yeah, I mean, I think that basically saying, here's the respectable way.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, part of it is, it's not wrong. That is to ask their permission and show up when they ask you to and take a couple photos. And that means that all the photos are taken. Now we are done.
Mm-hmm.
that's better than certainly chasing someone into a tunnel in Paris.
Well, yeah, and they have Mario describing himself. He's like, we are hunters, killers. Yeah. Like, it's a violent profession, the way he describes it.
Yes, but I'm going to push back a little bit on sort of the Crown and them being less critical of the Crown, because that was so manipulative of them to hire their royalist little photographer to clap back at Diana to show that, oh, Charles the good dad, the good father, out with his kids while Diana's, you know, kissing a random man on a boat.
Kissing a brown guy on a boat.
Kissing a brown guy on a boat when Charles is wearing his kilt with the kids. I think the show was showing that the Crown was being manipulative right back. Yeah. Like, Mo was being manipulative, but so was the Queen. And they pulled out their ringer and they were like, we're going to use this guy because he loves us to take these photos to ruin Diana's public image.
Yeah, and like Charles's chief of staff or whoever that is, the PR guy.
And Mark Boland.
Mark Boland.
He's a real guy too.
Yeah. He, and that actor's really good who plays him, but he kind of lays out the sound of the dog whistle. He's like Mediterranean, kind of sleazy, like, you know, pizzazz, whatever. And
Scotland.
Then here we are in Scotland. It's, you know, it's respectable. It's whatever. Like, obviously those optics were heavily in play at this time. And I think that the balance that this episode does is smart. To be like, here were the two extremes as the public saw it, and we're going to kind of talk about how those extremes came to be, you know?
Yeah,
and it was all calculated.
And shows the ways in which they're unfair, too, because, you know, we also see Diana at her landmine conference, and she's trying so hard to, you know, spread awareness about this very real issue that's very close to her, and that is her chosen goodwill mission.
Yeah,
and
post-HRH. It's her first thing, really,
exactly,
that she's doing.
All they care about is Dodi.
All they care about is Dodi.
And I think that's why the episode's not called Three Photographs, because as famous as the Diana landmine photo is, not as famous as her and Dodi on the boat.
Yeah.
I mean,
Or Charles and the kids who did not want to wear kilts.
No, because their schoolmates.
I mean, if you're a 15-year-old boy, are you trying to wear a kilt in a picture with your dad?
That
well,
is
I
very
mean, for
true.
Chris and I, maybe.
Yeah, honestly. How much of my leg is showing?
We wouldn't have called it a kilt necessarily, but miniskirt. I think that, the scene with the boys taking the photo, those photos were iconic. They, you know, as we said, they were in, like, teen magazines in the U.S. and everything like that. But they were just as much of a show. And actually, Diana and Dodi, that's not a show. They didn't think they were being photographed.
They didn't know.
Yeah.
He was instead, in this show's argument, betrayed by his father.
Yeah, and I mean, it does also show a bit of still Diana not just being this, like, helpless, you know, pawn. Are we to believe that when Charles's, guy tells him that Diana told her favorite journalist that Charles spent the weekend with Camilla and he didn't want to see the boys, like, does the show saying that that's actually happened? Or is he just, like, trying to manipulate Charles? Like,
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure.
This is a question that I have, and maybe it's clear. I feel like the show is saying, or has said, Diana was really in love with Charles the whole entire time, and that Charles was emotionally unavailable because he was in love with Camilla, and that's why the relationship didn't work. Was that always what people thought, that Diana was truly, madly, deeply, helplessly devoted to Charles, and that he fumbled it?
No.
Definitely
okay,
not, yeah.
That's, I felt like, I was like, that's not how I even remember it. I thought it was, you know.
You're referring to the thing where they're at the car, the boys are in the car, and they're talking and saying, like, we're going to have a great divorce.
So proud of you.
Thank you.
Can I make a request? Even though we weren't brilliant at being married, can we be brilliant at all this?
I think so.
And not just for them, but for us too.
And Diana's like, well, I'll just, you know, she says nobly, you know, despite being second fiddle. And it's like, second fiddle? Like, you didn't like him.
You didn't like him. And she said, there are other moments, I think, in the first episode and in this episode where she, connecting with Dodi, she was like, you know, like, I loved him and he didn't, you know, then my life was a nightmare. Where I was like, I never believed that Diana really liked Charles all that much.
Well, and also in the show kind of argued, you know, she was trying to hook a fish too when she first met him. Like, is like that she wanted to be the Queen of England. I don't know.
Who her older sister was supposed to be with Charles.
Exactly.
Then he saw her
in that season. Yeah, I think the dynamics of that are interesting. And I do think in some ways the show is not entirely sure where it wants to put any sort of moral favor. Maybe it doesn't have to. I mean, it can be ambivalent about it, you know.
You can just kind of throw all the possibilities out there and, you know, leave it to us to use our own biases to decide what we choose to believe.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, for all of Diana's, you know, gallivanting, which horrifies the queen and everyone else, like, there is a genuine bond between her and Dodi that I think is well drawn out. And we also see her being so good with the kids. Mm-hmm. And when she says goodbye to them, we're understanding that as the last time, right? Yes. Like, and I think that makes those scenes so poignant.
And, yeah. Well, the scenes between her, between her and the kids for sure, but then that last scene with her and Charles was landed on thick. Yeah.
It's a little bit like, no, Charles is great. The show has always been very pro-Charles.
Super pro-Charles in a way that I think it sticks out.
Yeah, well, I think it's maybe
that's just, though, because I assumed, because of press, that Charles is
despicable.
Yeah, which is, you know, and as much a narrative as anything on this show, I guess, right? Yeah. You know, there's another side.
Yeah, because they're always like, oh, Charles, he's so brilliant. If only he could have a chance to shine.
He just wants to modernize the monarchy and nobody believes him. And he's so intellectual. And yeah, I don't know.
Have you ever seen the video of some people, like kind of mountain bikers, were out biking on the Balmoral Estate in Scotland, which is like massive, and they just they had GoPro cameras, and they just happened to run into Prince Charles alone on a walk. Mm-hmm. And so he's talking to them like this, like the Prince, now King of England, just talking to these random guys.
When-ish is this?
This is probably in the last 10 years.
Okay. So is this your summer vacation to Balmoral, is it?
The weather was better.
I know, it's typical. Yeah. The images are horrendous. Yeah.
The worst I felt this year was this morning.
Yeah.
And it's like Charles is fucking alien. Like, he's so, to borrow Mrs. Blair's line from the first episode, like, he's so weird. And it's like, oh, maybe he did break dance however long ago, but this is not a normal person. Yeah. Like, and I think this show
can't speak like a human being.
He's talk. Like, oh, yeah, it's very stiff and sort of like he just
can't
has no
connect.
Like this. These people are so beneath him in the sort of social hierarchy that it's like, aren't you supposed to be bringing me something or whatever? Like, you know. And I think that this show casting Dominic West, which is crazy.
It is crazy. We have to say it.
He is so much handsomer.
It's absolutely astounding. And it's warping my perception of what Charles looks like.
Exactly, but that's all part of this show's weird pro-Charles bias. No, I don't know anything that... Look, we know a lot about his brother that's bad, concretely.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know that I know anything concretely bad about Charles other than what we can kind of assume someone growing up in that becomes, you know.
But you know that he carried on an affair with Camilla in a very blatant and, like, very...
mean.
You know, publicly mean kind of way during his marriage. Like, you know, you can say what you will about
he doesn't
have
their a spotless record.
like their love obviously was thwarted for like dumb reasons, and Charles and Camilla should have gotten married in 1980 or whatever, and like none of this would have ever happened. Mm-hmm. But you know, when he is married to Diana and still like not even trying to hide the fact that he has basically another wife, like that's pretty. That's pretty awful. That's a pretty awful thing to do to somebody.
If Charles and Camilla had gotten married in 1980, would Meghan Markle still be on Suits?
Suits would still be running, and the world would be better.
Suits might have never existed. Suits. It might have been called coats.
The butterfly effect of this is too much.
Bomber jackets.
Mind-boggling.
With Camilla, this was the episode, if I'm not mistaken, where Mark Boland is like, you could be queen. Right? Mm-hmm. Is where they finally...
Yeah, the public is finally talking about you as a possibility.
As a possibility.
That.
Yeah. And that...
Like they're forgiving you,
They're forgiving you, and is that something that you would... And asks her point blank, period, is that something that you would want? Is that something that you would like? Mm-hmm. And like, she's like, I could never say the word. I would never do it. But like, it's interesting to think of like those machinations, because it took a hell of a long time. It's what, 2023? Like, that for her to sort of get there and for that to happen... for many reasons, but to think of that strategic conversation happening is so compelling to me as like, wow, like not only is she trying to just like marry the love of her life, but she's got to think about how am I going to make all of the British people love me?
Yeah.
Or at least tolerate me.
Yeah. And like, and that project is going to get a lot more complicated after the deification of her boyfriend's ex-wife.
Yeah. I think the tension that this season and look, the arrival of Diana is what began it, obviously, but like of the royal family realizing that the public's attention is elsewhere because media consumption is changing. We're talking about early internet. I mean these Diana photos were mostly disseminated in newspapers. It wasn't really an online phenomenon because it's a little too early for that. But like, we're seeing this family turn
AOL
to confront,
keyword Diana,
right,
Diana
exactly.
Picks.
Yeah, we're seeing the family sort of slowly turn to face the fact that like, what's coming for them is a continual fight for relevance. Mm-hmm. And I think that Charles in these two episodes, these first two episodes, being so indignant about like what I want. And it's like, what are you going to read? A polite write up of a birthday party, or, you know, three men in Scotland, you know, standing on rocks,
or sexy lady on a yacht.
Like, yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously they've contended with those problems in the past, but it's really like the late 90s into the 2000s when the royal family is really like, wait, people just don't innately care about us anymore.
And also that he feels entitled not just to positive press, but like unambiguously, like enthusiastically positive. Mm-hmm. Like it can't just be like tacitly approving. It has to be vocal, like full-throated, we love you kind of stuff, right. which is interesting and like pathological in its own way too.
Yeah.
But he wants the stuff that was engendered by, you know, his mother, mm-hmm. but his mother like saw Britain through a lot of tough times. Her father saw them mm-hmm. through World War II. Like, you know, we're talking about an older generations mm-hmm. of people who really saw them as emblems of the country. People in the 90s and who are Charles's age or younger were like, what have they done for us?
Well, yeah. he learned Welsh that one time.
Okay,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the only people that care about him is that old photographer, you know. Right. The only guy who cares.
Right. Yeah.
I do think, and I, it's sort of a question, because in my head, was Diana the most famous woman in the world?
Yes.
She was objectively the most famous,
absolutely.
Even before her death, because that's the thing that I, like, absolutely. And the resentment that you feel this episode from, I mean, you feel it from the Queen all the time, but from mm-hmm. Charles, from the whole, it's so palpable, because they sort of created this mm-hmm. monster.
Yeah.
They created, it's kind of like...
It's like Frankensteinian.
Yes, yeah. Where they created the monster. They created the most famous woman in the world who's set out to destroy the monarchy. And I love that.
Which is why, I mean, this is me putting my tinfoil hat on, but like, it's why Kate Middleton was so carefully selected, because she stays in line and she's very pretty, but she's not too pretty and she's not going to be on any yachts. Like, you know, like mm-hmm. that was like a very, I'm not saying, maybe I think that William and her genuinely met and loved each other and whatever and mm-hmm. still do. But I do think that Kate Middleton was a very, very anti-Diana choice, yes. Very deliberately.
Calculated. And then Harry went and, you know.
Found another Diana
in his own way.
Well,
different, yeah. Sort of different, but also more similar than Kate, at least.
Right.
Imagine Diana's lifestyle blog for just one moment. One
Goob
beautiful
caught
moment.
Dead in a ditch.
What'd she be doing? That's a great.
Well, she would have had a column for her psychic.
Oh.
Who she visits in a helicopter in just like a throwaway scene.
That was amazing. What is the budget on this show?
I love to think of Netflix just giving like $3 million, just being like, you know, whatever. Yeah, we'll have 5 seconds of this helicopter.
No dialogue.
Elizabeth is like, this is terrifying some small town. Like, but I love the psychic just running up with the wind, you know, on her. And she's as if this happens every day. She's like, oh, yeah, come on in, you know.
That does sort of feel like a detail that Peter Morgan read. And he was like, this is so good. I got to find a place for it. And then it was like the day before the end of the shoot. And he's like, oh, no, I want to put the psychic thing in.
It does show me, like, you know, because I didn't pay a ton of attention to this before it happened. I remember being woken up by my mother to be told that Diana had died. But, like, totally had missed that Dodi fully was engaged to someone, that was like a big matter of public, like mm-hmm. that was of scrutiny, obviously, mm-hmm. because it was like, wait a second, you know, this woman who was jilted in the course of weeks adds an interesting element to it. Does it make Dodi seem worse, or does it make his love to Diana like feel that much stronger? I mean, I, you know.
Well, I will say, not to say anything ill of Kelly Fisher, our colleague.
We have to explain that
there is a Kelly Fisher who works at VF with us. Yeah.
She's not, in fact, the same Kelly Fisher.
She's not actually the same Kelly Fisher.
She has another last name too.
Kelly Fisher Butler. Yeah. But okay, so say nothing ill of Kelly Fisher,
the model.
The model. Suing him for the broken engagement, that is weird. To me, mm-hmm. that was like the breach of contract.
Yeah.
That gives like, okay, so did you love him or did you just want to be a billionaire wife?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's always a question in this world, you know, whether it's
that's also sort of proving Muhammad right, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
I believe that Dodi's love. I feel like, how could you not be infatuated with Diana? Mm-hmm. Like, she's the most famous woman in the world. She seems lovely and sweet and sharp and
she seems fun,
broken and fun in a way that a lot of people aren't. So I do believe that he totally fell head over heels with her and was like, yeah, let's do this. I'm more interested to see Diana's perspective on their relationship, or when we're going to see, like, how in it is she? Like, how in it was she?
Yeah. Like, is she just doing this because it's fun to go on a boat? Or, yeah, is she really interested in him as well?
Yeah, and that we haven't really, I feel like, fully parsed yet, because right now they're just, like, having fun.
She's still sort something of a mystery, I guess, and, you know, that's deliberate, I think, that, like, Diana was sort of unknowable, and, yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought it was also interesting the way this episode did a little bit of sort of like economic history, where it was like the paparazzi, for me, this was like the first time I'd really heard that word was surrounding this story. And then obviously in the celebrity realm of the 2000s, it was such a thing with all the starlets and all that. And for to my mind, it was always like, well, there's just this sort of like weird species that just popped up. And it's like this episode is like, no, there was a legitimate economic incentive here.
Yeah.
This one person made millions of dollars. And so why wouldn't everybody else try to follow suit? I mean, or of a certain, you know, people who are willing to do that. And it doesn't, I mean, I guess it humanizes them. It doesn't make them more sympathetic necessarily, but like money was at the heart of all of this. These paparazzi aren't just doing it because they're obsessed with chasing celebrities.
Yeah. And adding to that, Diana knows them by name because they're around so much, and that they, like, she's like, oh, that's Tom, that's George, how's your kids? Like, that there's a relationship there. They're not just like random vultures who are picking apart this woman. It's like, it's their careers. And
well, and it's a symbiotic relationship in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because she needs them in a way. And as
if she's going to steal focus from Charles and Camilla.
Yeah, she's going to take away from Camilla's 50th birthday party. Then she better be on good enough terms with them.
I mean, it's wild also that she was 36.
That is really, especially to you have like a son who's like 16.
A 15-year-old kid, yeah. She was so young when all of this started.
She was 19
when she got
married. Yeah, 19. Insane.
It is really, putting all that together.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know the story of Diana. You know, I know about the Beanie Babies. I know about the car crash. I know.
To be fair, there's only one Beanie Baby.
The one Beanie Baby.
We were talking about Camilla's Beanie Baby collection.
Of course. Yeah. But when you put
the
all
Diana the one's the one she doesn't have.
She never will. Yeah. But when you put it all together, the 8 weeks with Dodie, the divorce, the kids, it really just makes it sort of like the most compelling soap opera narrative of all time.
You can understand why this story is as fascinating now as it was 30 years ago, why we're probably going to keep retelling it over and over and over.
And impossible to resist. I mean, my mom, who woke me up in the middle, me and my sister up, to tell us, like, PhD, scientist, very smart person, woke up real early to watch the wedding because she was already obsessed with Diana. Yeah. Like, everybody was. It was just, it was such an interest because she was this breath of fresh air in this musty old institution, which turns out was the problem because the musty old institution didn't want the fresh air it thought it wanted.
No, it wanted to be stuck in that crypt.
And yet they needed her, and they could have done such good stuff with her. That's sort of another part of the tragedy is that, like, if they had embraced her instead of being like, you're in or you're out, like, something really world-changing could have transpired.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't let her in. Ugh,
you're going to start singing songs from Diana the Musical. What should we do an episode about?
A pretty, pretty
about?
Girl in a pretty, pretty dress. Oh, we honestly could.
We should do a bonus episode about it.
We should.
Because I haven't seen
pretty,
it since,
Pretty, pretty girl. Yeah, that's a good, I know some
you
of those songs.
You could just perform it.
I could just do it. But it just, it's really hard. It's just, I'm not on the Queen's side right now. I'll say that.
Heaven forfend, Christopher.
You forget yourself. Still watching, we'll be back in a moment. When we return, we're calling out Vanity Fair Royal Watcher Aaron Vanderhoof.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So this episode sets up a battle of two photographs that were fighting for attention. But who is the ultimate champion?
So to help us navigate this world of royals, we're going to phone a friend. We're going to ask one of our Vanity Fair experts to weigh in.
Yeah, today we have Vanity Fair staff writer and co-host of the Dynasty podcast, Aaron Vanderhoof. Hello, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me. Get to talk about my favorite topic.
Yes, it's so nice to have a real royals expert because I've seen every season of The Crown, but I do not know as much about the royal family as you.
Well, and I think that this episode actually gets into what I think is really perfect about The Crown as a viewing experience, but then obviously very frustrating for a lot of the experts. Like, what Peter Morgan does a great job of is doing one very particular view of all of these things. Mm-hmm. And then it's, you know, the more you stay in this world, the more you understand the way that everybody else has very different opinions, and like mostly everybody does, you know, that it's not things that really contradict. Though in this episode, there's one thing that I was like very surprised, a choice that they made that I was just like, oh wow, and then sent me down a rabbit hole.
So, in this episode that we're talking about, episode two, it's called Two Photographs. It's a kind of compare and contrast narrative between the paparazzo who takes the pictures of Diana and Dodi on the yacht. According to the show, he is put up to this by Mohammed Al-Fayed, although it seems like that is something that the show invented, and the royal photographer who shoots the princes and Charles in Scotland looking, you know, very... Yeah.
The like, revenge photo.
Yes, very, very, like, fresh-faced and wholesome and...
In the kilt.
Yes, in the kilt.
So, yes, you were about to say something when I mentioned that about the paparazzo and Mohammed Al-Fayed, so please.
So I think I will say there's a lot of debate about who put Mario Brenna up to that. The person that I have read who's like the most firm that it was Diana is Tina Brown. Tina Brown has
so she
written,
thinks Diana actually reached out herself.
Yes, and that the reason was that she wanted to make her other ex-boyfriend, Hasnat Khan, she wanted to make him jealous.
Okay.
So I, on the other hand, there's a lot of debate about whether it was somebody close to Dodi, somebody close to Diana, whether it was, I mean, I think that, you know, it's one of those things that cannot really be definitively disproven.
And the photographer himself said it was just like happenstance, that it just like happened.
Yeah, what does Mario Brenna say? Yeah.
Yeah, he said that he was, you know, that he got a hint that they might be there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the decision in context makes so much sense because we've spent, you know, more than a season kind of building up Mohammed Al-Fayed as this character who has his own ambitions and aims and, like, really trying to take him on his own terms, even if that's not totally flattering. I think that in the context of the story that this episode is telling and that the season is telling, you know, I think that that view of Dodi, I mean, that actually, I believe, is what his accent really sounded like. Mm-hmm. You know, the actor said last time around that he had the only sound of his recording of his voice that they could find was him calling into Larry King Live.
Whoa.
Yeah, in like the 80s. So that's really what he sounded like. But I think that kind of him being this kind of more hapless nerd who's pulled in a lot of directions is very different from, you know, I can remember reading about it in Vanity Fair when I was probably 8 or 9, that like the idea of this like international playboy who, you know, was
party boy and wild and crazy.
But maybe now that it's like an adult, I understand that people can be that and nerds.
Yeah.
Also just big, deeply
whoa,
nerds.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah. But I do really think that, and it comes back to the royals, so you get the sense that everybody is playing with something that's a lot bigger and more risky and dangerous than they can even understand. And so I think that making Mohammed the person who puts in the call, I think if we're in the long run trying to look at this at, like, you know, Mohammed, the guy who bought the house that used to belong to the Duke of Windsor, the guy who bought the yacht just to renovate it, the guy who, you know, sought out Diana in the right place. If we're looking at him as like a player in this game in that way, you know, I think the story that the season, last season and the season is telling, I feel like it was a really great choice. I'm really curious for the rest of the season, you know, how he's going to deal with it when his son dies. Because what we know from real life, he actually just passed away about 2 months ago. And he was crushed by the death of his son. His entire life was sort of formed around it. He became, like, the biggest proponent of all the conspiracy theories. Mm. Like, it really, really crushed him. And so I'm interested in if seeing his role or his machinations in their you know, meeting is so important. I wonder how that's going to play into the rest of the season.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's really interesting because we've taken some issue, or some of us have taken some issue with pinning it all on Muhammad in terms of like, oh, like a scary brown man is now pulling the strings and is responsible for, you know, Diana's death. But from a narrative perspective, and as this is, as you said, it is a, you know, a fictionalized narrative based on true events. It is a compelling narrative in mm-hmm. terms of his overarching sort of motivations mm-hmm. and objectives. I want to sort of go back to the actual two photographers, because as a, you know, a novice in the Royals world, I'm like, oh, well, obviously they both were real and existed, and this definitely happened because it's on the ground. So Mario Brenna, we know, is a real person.
He's a real guy.
Duncan Muir, the Royalist photographer, was he a real guy? Is that a real photographer?
So there are a lot of different Royal photographers that this could be. I mean, it really does seem, both in appearance and in vibe, like a lot of different guys I've met before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you've met,
and there is one guy named Duncan. There's a couple people whose last name is Muir who, like, we could be talking about. But, like, of that day, the picture that's the most iconic, with, like, Charles kind of, like, looking out over in the kilt, that was taken by Tim Graham, who's one of my favorite, you know, royal photographers, and he's really lovely. I think that the idea here was to—I mean, I think with Mario Brenna, like, they're putting him in a really specific situation— they kind of do need to have the specific person. And making the money off of that photo, like, changed his life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that's something kind of more documentable. On that day, there would have been a much bigger press pack. And that idea that—
The day that the Charles and—
Yeah, and mm-hmm. Balmoral.
And Princes.
There would have had a larger group of people that came out for that. But I think that what the portrayal is getting at that is really true, and I've experienced it in my interactions with these people, is that— especially in the UK, the reporters themselves, some of them have, you know, more complicated feelings about the royals than others. Some of them are really doing this to promote the monarchy. Others are really doing this because it's just their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But the photographers, I feel like pretty universally, that are the full-time royal photographers, have so much respect for Queen Elizabeth. That thing that she's the person that unites us is like a thing that so many different people could have said. And it's just very, very true and accurate about the way that a lot of these people approach their job.
I'm sure that many of them are crusty and old, and no offense to the show's actor. He looked very distinguished. Distinguished mm-hmm. is a kinder way
but a specific type of distinguished.
What I love the most is that the guys who were probably that age in 1997, a lot of them are still at it, and they have to have so much stamina to do it. And every time I've seen it in person, I'm just like, you guys, I really hope that I'm anywhere like close to as enthusiastic about this.
Yeah, do you want to share any of your in-person experiences with royal photographers or royal press?
My personal favorite is I have been on a boat following Prince William, but I was with his press people. They invited me to be there. But the incredible thing is, like, it's like, you know, half reporters, half photographers, and the photographers were all lined up to get pictures. But when you turn, you know, your orientation relative to William changes. And so then all the photographers go running to the other side of the boat. And you have to then, all the reporters have to then run to the other side of the boat
Boats can tip over,
yeah.
They can do that.
When you say exhausting, you mean literally.
Yeah, and it's
we're
raining.
Doing cardio.
Yeah, we're doing
from
cardio.
From port to starboard. You
know, just, oh my God, look at him.
About a thing or two.
Nautical nonsense.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's the thing, is that people are so, so serious about it. And I mean, I think even know from watching, I think Framing Britney Spears is the one that did the best of talking about the economics of that industry and how in the 90s, they just totally changed and made it so that one good picture could change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's not like that. But I think that the news photography, the people who, you know, that there are very few opportunities in news photography now where you get to take lots of pictures of photogenic people who show up where they're supposed to be at the time that they say they'll be there.
Yeah.
And that there are people who will be in the historical record, so you can build a portfolio of, like, iconic pictures that will matter someday. And so I think that you just get, like, this tier of people who are super, super, super dedicated to and really love what they're doing. So that's, like, the contrast is, like, somebody who's really trying to get that image that's going to change their lives versus the people who are there trying to nurture those relationships and want their images to be you know, something that will last.
Yeah, and so Diana doesn't have access really to the—well, I mean, she has access to any photographer that she wants, I guess, in theory, but she doesn't have, you know, the royal court kind of, like, at her beck and call, and she has to deal with, you know, even when she's giving the paparazzi something, you know, in order to try to barter with them a little bit, she's still kind of at their mercy.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that this episode of Too Farish does really well is understanding that even in the 1990s, like, there was already this sense that an image of Princess Diana could be worth a lot of money. But it's not until you get the first images of Princess Diana, like, dating, that, like, the frenzy goes from... And I think that we're laying the groundwork for why is it... Because I think that when you learn the story of what happened to Princess Diana, and, you know, I remember the night she died really vividly. I don't understand. I mean, I loved her so much, I guess, which is why I do this as my job. But I think that it is really hard to understand, like, what was so important about that picture that night that caused so many people to be following them. And the episode kind of lays the groundwork for there has been this exogenous reason why the worth of a photograph like that has skyrocketed recently, which means that a lot of people are looking at this could be something really important if I get the
right photo.
Yeah, if Mario
Brown can become a millionaire.
Yeah, I can too. Yeah. What have you thought of the season thus far? The first two episodes.
Oh, I think that the moment I knew that I was really just going to have a great time was when Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba dropped. I have to say that's not very accurate. Like, Diana probably, I feel like Diana...
She was not a Chumbawamba fan.
She was not a Chumbawamba fan in real life.
We have that on the record. We know that to be true.
Well, it's more, I think that this happened last season too, but I loved it. But they had a moment where she was listening to Mazzy Star and another one where she was listening to, it was like... Diegetic, but Girl Like You by Edwin Collins. And it's like Princess Diana's musical knowledge stops at Simply the Best. Like, she really, really likes 80s pop. She
80s
loves
pop.
Billy Joel.
Uh-huh.
She
Tina
loves
Turner,
Elton John.
She
She's less like a 90s girl, but they do a great job of, you know, really locating you in the moment.
Did she like Smash Mouth? That's the one. We do have to know that.
Sadly, I feel like the Smash Mouth Diana like overlap, the Venn diagram was so short that I don't think we can know for sure. Mm.
But it's really the greatest tragedy of that 1997 car crash. I'm sorry, this is very inappropriate.
But true. Still Watching will be back in just a moment, and when we return, time to break out the yacht rock and celebrate the 90s.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
All right, before we go, let's once again look at the time capsule that is this show. There's a lot of 90s culture thrown around, obviously, because it's set in the 90s. Did anything kind of retro jump out at you guys?
I mean, being in media, I was just looking at the 11-page spread in a tabloid magazine. Yeah. Like, can you imagine having that much real estate?
All that. No
All
ads.
That paper.
That means you have 11 ad pages to sort of balance it out,
well,
right?
Yeah. Well, and also just the idea that you could become a millionaire based on one set of pictures at a time when everybody just didn't have a camera with them all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because their phones couldn't take photos.
Yeah.
Now any Monaco...
They didn't have phones
even. They didn't have phones like that.
I mean, some people did, but...
Now any Monaco teen could have taken those photos.
Would have put it on TikTok and everybody would have forgotten
and
about it.
And they would have got a million likes, but that's not $1 million.
Are teenagers in Monaco? I've been to Monaco twice. I don't think I've ever seen a teenager who seemed to live there.
Yeah. According to The Crown, there's a bunch of American teenagers in Monaco. In the next episode, we'll see them.
Oh, okay.
That is true.
Well, that's
true.
An interesting tea. Stay tuned for next week, the episode of The Crown about Monacan teens.
Who speak English. Similarly to Hillary, from a media perspective, at the very beginning of the episode where they're talking about Mohammed's citizenship and whatnot. And they are like, and we just started this new website, royal.uk.gov. And it's just like three photos on an HTML page. Right.
So, that, like someone made in like internet class?
Literally.
In the computer lab.
Computer lab. And it's so, and this is like the royal family.
I used HyperCard to make you this.
Yeah. It is actually not very much more sophisticated now.
Oh, no, it really isn't.
Royal.uk still exists, God, please.
That Patreon link is rude. Come on, guys. You have enough.
That really sent
it
me.
It takes you to the UK tax website.
I just liked all the kind of nostalgia, like the Duran Duran T-shirts and, you know, Daft Punk music cues and stuff. Like, it doesn't feel overbearing the way the show. It's actually, like, kind of just beaming me back into that time, which, you know, because this is now, I was 14, so that was old enough that I remember that.
You remember the summer of 1997?
I do. I remember feeling some of that music and some of those things. Mm-hmm. So then eventually in this season, I think in the latter half, we're going to get into like much more modern, and then I'll reject it.
That's too close.
Once we're in 2000.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's too close. All right, well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can email us any questions, concerns. Do people have theories about this? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
If so, I got bad news.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you have a theory, please send it. Yeah. I'd be curious to read it and remind you what year it is. You can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can find me on various social medias at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on the same ones at Christris.
And my handle is Hillabuster with two R's. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Thursday for episode 3. Looking forward to seeing you then.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself, when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency, we're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.